All right. So welcome. George Draffin, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you doing today, George?
All right, how are you?
Pretty good, actually. I'm feeling pretty good. So welcome to, I guess you're speaking to people here in Guelph, Ontario. And so maybe you want to start off with talking a bit about who you are, and maybe to start off with the topic of a book you wrote with Derek Jensen called Welcome to the Machine. Maybe why you wrote that book and what it's all about.
Right. I've been an environmental activist for many years, and we kind of reluctantly resisted getting into economics and politics. We were interested in my case, I was interested in saving the old growth forests, the ancient forests around the world. But I soon came to realize that it wasn't a question of the U.S. Forest Service controlling what was going on, that politics and ultimately economics and some other levels of society were controlling what was happening in the forest. And so I've focused more and more on political and economic issues, corporate power and global trade and some of the technologies that are used to support those things. So I do freelance research for environmental groups and community groups, public interest organizations. And I'm a friend of Derek Jensen's, and he had heard of some technologies that are used for surveillance and control, and we started doing some research on those. And we discovered some pretty scary technologies, but the longer we looked at it, the more we realized that, again, it was the social relations, the power relations and politics that were actually driving the technology. And so we wanted to write a book that kind of looked at what is it that causes humans to set up surveillance and control systems? Why do leaders do that? Why do things seem to lead always to war and security and surveillance, and why do people in society allow it?
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know, maybe before we get into some details, like, do you want to talk a bit about the social issues behind all this control? Like, why do people allow it, and how have we gotten to the state where we've allowed so many freedoms to be taken away and not even feel like it has been taken away from us?
Yeah, I think that's the central question, and that's what we wanted to explore in Welcome to the Machine. I'm not sure we have any, real simple or satisfying answers, but I think it, one example is after the events of 9/11 and the rush to war, people kind of, the question came up, how much security do we need? How tight do we want to make the borders in the United States? How much surveillance should we do of people who come in from other countries with passports? Those questions naturally arose. How secure can we make the country, and how far do we want to go? Is there a balance with privacy? Is there a balance with freedom? And I think Derek and I came to the conclusion that it's a false choice, that privacy is actually an illusion. It's a distraction from bigger questions about who's got power over who, and it's a distraction from the larger question of freedom and power and how society is constructed and how we live our lives. And as we looked at the historical record, we discovered some pretty shocking things. I mean, criminals at least from the Middle Ages on, criminals were often tattooed, or they'd even have their ears docked to mark them as criminals. It was a way of identifying people, sorting people, and branding people. And about the time in the 1800s, early 1800s, when this began to be frowned upon, democracy was rising and political revolutions, 1848, there were revolutions in Europe. The harsh treatment of prisoners and poor people began to be frowned on. And about this time, fingerprints were discovered. People had unique fingerprints, and also about this time, photography was invented. And within 10 years of the invention of photography, over 500,000 gypsies had been photographed in Europe. People that were itinerant, they traveled around, they didn't hold jobs, they didn't have property, they weren't under anybody's control. But within a decade of the invention of photography, over 500,000 of them had been photographed in Germany and in Switzerland especially, but in other countries also. And those photographs were put in a file so that they could be tracked. And if there were crimes committed, you know, a database of people that were suspect could be searched. We discovered that with passports, with any kind of identification, whether it's criminal, it soon becomes applied to the population at large. Passports begin to be used. Any time there's a war, the security apparatus gets cranked up, and then after the war, it never goes away. So passports were used first as a wartime measure, and often to keep draft-age young men from leaving the country. Passports were originally used to keep people from leaving the country rather than for people entering the country. But then by the time of World War I, passports were required for travel in Europe between countries. After the war, those requirements were not lifted. And we see the same thing after 9/11. You know, the Patriot Act was first passed as a temporary emergency measure to protect the country in a time of war, and now, of course, those provisions are becoming permanent. So that's that obsession with security starts out usually during war, during times of crisis, and there's a rationale for it, we're afraid, and so we go for security over privacy and freedom. But with the passing decades, we lose more and more of our freedom, and surveillance and security and control kind of become the organizing principle of society. Why that is, or you know, what to do about it, I don't think that's a simple question to answer. But you can look at the history, especially of the last couple hundred years, of science and military organization being mechanisms for the sorting and surveillance and control of society. It serves that function. And as usual with technology, once something's invented and starts to be used, it's rarely it's never taken away. It's once something begins to be used, either politically or administratively or technologically, it tends to become a permanent feature of society.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of the term technology creep, and how often things are introduced as seemingly innocuous or innocent, civilian things, but they really have military measures or whatnot. And I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about that and how that relates to this whole triad of science, military, and the government.
Yeah, it's hard to say which comes first. there is technology creep, and I think there's also kind of political creep or agenda creep, where something is invented, ostensibly for. Pure scientific purposes, which personally I think is a myth, but that's often, photography, internal combustion. Look at any invention, really. Immediately it's used for military purposes. The airplane was invented, and within just a few years, we were using them for dropping bombs and surveillance of enemies. I've already mentioned fingerprints, originally used to identify criminals, but quickly used to sort and identify and control ethnic populations. Same thing with passports, photography, you name it. It's that the military applications of it are soon exploited. And the reverse is also true. A lot of inventions are originally military. I mean, that is where the money where the money comes from. I read some studies in the 1980s. I suspect the numbers haven't changed a whole lot, but those studies said that over half the scientists and engineers in the United States, these are university scientists and engineers, are employed by the military, either directly or indirectly under military contract. So, and the computer, the internet, a lot of things were originally invented by the military for military purposes and then exploited commercially after that. So, and like the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of the Pentagon, U.S. Department of Defense, Pentagon, is kind of the far-out science wing. They've got about a $3 billion budget, and they're into everything from the software and hardware that's necessary for large-scale surveillance programs to blocking pain and fear, the drugs and other technologies that could be used to block pain and fear in soldiers, so that you'd have soldiers that would feel no fear, no pain, could go without sleep. The uniforms and armor that could be used to coagulate blood so that wounds wouldn't stop a soldier. They're interested in aerial drones, unmanned vehicles, airplanes, cameras, things for spying. They're interested in space weapons. They're even interested. I mean, genetic research now is being used to sort different ethnic populations to figure out which populations are susceptible to which kinds of biologic warfare. So, it's just some of this stuff is just scary and insidious, and other things are seem very mechanical. And who wouldn't want to block a pain in for the medical uses of that? But again, this is being run by the military, so that function creep, what it's going to be used for, and who's going to control that technology is more the essential question than can it be invented or should it be invented. Those things are just never seem to be on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And the stuff is being done in the universities of the United States and Europe. It looks like academic research. It's being done in medical institutes, but it's being funded by the military.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to talk a bit more about some of the stuff going on in DARPA that I think some people would be really interested in hearing about? Like, for example, the radio frequency ID chips and how the military is kind of combining with consumer agencies and big corporations and all that. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, it's one thing that was in the initial applications of radio frequency ID tags. There are in the commercial arena. Everybody's familiar with barcodes, but now there are chips. I think they've got them smaller than a grain of rice, that are actually being put inside items of clothing. And you can do more than scan with a barcode. You can actually track them from several feet or several yards away. You can actually track items in a commercial inventory in a factory and on into the store shelves. So Walmart has explored putting these ID tags in every item, say in the drug and cosmetics department of a superstore, so that you can track each individual item that comes out of a factory from the factory to the transport system into the retail store. But what happens when people buy it? If each article of clothing, every backpack, every shoe has got one of these radio frequency ID tags, then when you walk back into the store, you could be scanned for your clothing and whatever products you're carrying, and they could direct advertisements that would be customized for the products that you've bought in the past. So it obviously has surveillance capabilities, especially if the radio frequency capabilities are extended to a greater distance. If they could somehow be combined with GPS, the global positioning satellites, where you can identify an object, a vehicle, or an object, or a person anywhere on Earth. I mean, cell phones are like that now. Most cell phones, at least the newer cell phones, you can actually, if you have the equipment, and of course the governments and large commercial entities and the military are the only ones that ever have the equipment and the budget to do it, but cell phone calls now can usually, you can track it to whatever specific point the telephone is at. So if someone's traveling in a car or someone's sitting in a building and they make a cell phone call, you can actually pinpoint that location.
Mm-hmm.
And these chips are small enough. I think about 10,000 people now have them actually have had them inserted under their skin, so the person themselves becomes traceable. And as usual, there's you can come up with some rationales for why you would do that. Some corporate executives who live and travel in foreign countries where there's some risk of kidnapping have submitted to this. It's been proposed to for people that have Alzheimer's disease to put one of these little chips under the skin, on their arm.
Mm-hmm.
And if they wander off, you can find them. Why not put it in school children in case they, they're kidnapped? You can trace and identify and save a child who's been kidnapped. But why not just insert them under the skin of every baby when they're born, and put their social security number with it and their fingerprints, and put them all on a computer chip that can be read from a distance by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So, the function creep is just, it's creepy.
Mm-hmm. There's always that saying that, if we have nothing to hide, then we shouldn't be afraid. But what I like in Welcome to the Machine is that you outline a lot of scenarios with encounters with police where all these technologies would work horribly against us. And a lot of these things are pretty scary to think about implications for people who won't just sit back and watch a world, go further and further down the tube.
Yeah, it's scary, if it's connected with the military or if it's connected with, one of the spy agencies. These kind of doomsday scenarios are the ones that, really scare people. But there, too, I'm actually more concerned about what we do to ourselves, what happens psychologically and socially as we become accustomed to this. We allow it to happen. We buy into the rationale for it, and after a while, we don't. The larger questions of freedom and responsibility and power relations and how society is conducted are no longer even in our awareness. And one of the images that we used in Welcome to the Machine is the Panopticon, and that was a strange name that would Jeremy Bentham, who was a lawyer and a political scientist in the 17 and 1800s in Europe, came up with this. He had a plan. It was originally an architectural plan for a prison, and his idea was that if you had a central tower and the wings of the prison came off that central tower so that the central tower could see into each of the wings, you would have lights on in all the wings of the prison. So the cells of the prisons, all the lights would be on. But in the central tower, the lights would be off. So the guards sitting in the central tower could see into the wings of the prison. They could see into every cell. Every prisoner would be visible to the guards in the central tower. But the prisoners couldn't see into the tower. So you had the architecture, the technology, for constant surveillance, 24 hours a day. And again, you know, the rationale, these people are in prison. They're dangerous. They need to be watched. But it's interesting when you read Jeremy Bentham's essays on this panopticon idea. It started out as an architectural plan for a prison, but he quickly realized it could be used in factories. You could keep an eye on the workers and on the different departments of the factories. And why not put it in insane asylums, the madhouses, as they called them then, to keep a watch on mentally ill people? Why not put them in hospitals and keep an eye on the patients? There could be a central tower in the hospital, and all the patients in the hospital could be monitored, of course, for their own health. Why not put it in schools? So what started out as a blueprint for a prison became useful in practically any institution of society. And Michel Foucault in the 1970s wrote a book called Discipline and Punish, where he looked at the panopticon, and he pointed out that it wasn't really an architectural thing. I mean, the building, modern prisons actually are based on something similar to the panopticon, but the panopticon is not really a building. It's a way of arranging society, and the essence of it is that you could be seen, you could be spied upon at any time. Things are arranged so that at any time you may be under surveillance, but you don't know whether you are or not. And that's really the scary part, is that when people think they're being watched, they behave differently. They behave as if, you know, they behave the way they need to if someone with greater power might be watching them. But in the end, it doesn't matter if you're being watched or not. You censor yourself. And that's what is really scary. I mean, the Pentagon has got awesome firepower, and we see that in the news every day. But ultimately, not everyone can be watched, and not everyone can be controlled. Things need to be arranged so that people control themselves, people censor themselves. And that's the hardest thing to get at, because once you start living that way, you don't even notice that you're censoring yourself, that fear and the ignorance of what's actually going on. Am I being watched? Am I being controlled or not? If you can't tell anymore, then you start to control yourself. And that's when you lose the ability to even know whether you're acting in your own interests or whether you're obeying the agenda that's been set up in society.
Mm-hmm. It works certainly well. It works in journalism, like all the self-censorship there, and it works everywhere, really.
Yeah, in environmental groups, it works. I have no naivety about the backlash and the the reaction that protest, whether it's in the environmental arena, whether it's in the political arena, whether it's in labor organizing. Hundreds of labor activists are murdered every year simply for their attempts to organize the workplace and have some control over their own work. So repression and coercion certainly does happen, but I've seen many more environmental groups destroyed by their own fear and their own censorship and their own kind of rearranging how they think and how they operate and how they make their decisions, and they destroy themselves much more efficiently than can be done by repression. And that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, was that we wanted people to not only to understand the technology, but to understand the power relations and the social arrangements and the political arrangements, but also kind of the internal social constructs that people impose upon themselves that become increasingly invisible as you become accustomed to living that way.
Can you talk a bit, can you explain a bit better what do you mean when you say you see all these environmental groups destroy themselves? Like, how do you, how exactly does that play out?
Well, on political levels, social levels, psychological levels, groups will censor their own agendas, their tactics, their goals, in order to get funding from a foundation. They need to raise money to pay staff. Foundations, you know, are reluctant to fund radical groups, so groups become more moderate to get funding. Or groups will be sued by a corporation. There's a current movie out. I think I'm not sure who produced it, but it's about McDonald's in England sued some activists.
McLibel, I think.
Yeah, McLibel.
Yeah.
And this was a case where the people didn't back down. McDonald's sued them for libel because they questioned the health of the food that McDonald's was producing. And they were sued for libel. In many cases, as soon as a group is sued, they'll start to censor themselves. They're so worried about what might happen, and they're so, you know, the lawsuits often target the individuals as well as the organization. So people are afraid. People are stressed out. People will stop being activists simply to protect their family and themselves, which, you know, there's always a rationale for what we do. But that's another piece of it, is the obsession with knowledge and control. Bureaucracy is essentially the administrative apparatus that's necessary for governing large systems. It was first arose in the 1800s and 1900s to enable the administration of industrial systems. You had, you know, billion-dollar stock markets and bond markets. You had national and international distribution systems. You had the companies with thousands of workers. And so the administrative apparatus had to be constructed to figure out how to administer such a large, complex system. That's essentially what bureaucracy is, and it involves sorting people. It involves making a system rational. It involves a total, you know, information about how the system's working and all the parts of it. It's the setting up and rationalizing of a large, complex system, and that's essentially what has happened in society. And it happens in large organizations, of regardless of what the stated mission is. In the Sierra Club and a large timber corporation have more in common than they do differences. Their stated mission is different. One of them is to, you know, preserve the environment, and one of them is to, you know, cut trees and make lumber. But they both have multi-million-dollar budgets. They have thousands of employees. They have constituencies. One that's called constituencies in the environmental group, and for the company, it's customers. But a large bureaucratic administrative system has to be imposed over both of them. So, and at this point, society itself has become a bureaucracy. And there's a myth of democracy out there. And that's what the rhetoric says. You know, that's the mission statement of the United States, if you will, is, you know, democracy and freedom. But you'll note how often democracy is equated with capitalism. And if you really look, the myth of democracy doesn't hold up. What we've got is a large industrial production system and a large bureaucratic political system. And we become the cogs in the machine. It's not just that the world has become a machine, or that we spend too much time watching TV or using computers, it's that we ourselves have become cogs in a rationalized bureaucratic machine. You begin to think in terms of the same way a machine does.
Can you talk a bit about, like we're talking a bit about here, how all this fits into our industrial civilization's larger quest for control? Can you talk a bit about where you see this going from your perspective? Your website is called Endgame, so I think that gives a hint as to perhaps, I guess, the urgency of the situation right now.
Yeah, although it's not, I'm actually quite dubious that there's going to be an apocalypse. I think a lot of environmentalists, a lot of social activists, start to despair of reform, and they have spent so much time looking at the destruction and atrocities of what's going on that you begin to wish for an apocalypse, a kind of an end to the political machine, or an end to the war, or an end to the destruction of nature, and you actually begin hoping for some kind of collapse. And I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I think we're in the midst of it. I think things are collapsing, but it happens at a very slow pace, which is one of the problems when feedback is constant. When you hear of the environmental crises and social crises and war, and you see the news day after day, it starts to become routine. And the feedback is so routine and so incremental that you begin not to listen to it. So, I mean, we're at the point now where many of the large animal species, wildlife species, are already extinct, and many more are going extinct. We've got a global warming situation that's already underway. And even if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, that global warming is going to continue for decades, if not hundreds of years. So the world is a big place, and whether you're looking at social relations and political systems, or whether you're looking at environmental systems, change takes place very slowly, and inertia, and momentum is built up. So I really don't think that. I'm 51, 52 years old, and I've been in environmental politics and social activism long enough that I've heard, species are going to go extinct within 10 years, or if this happens, it'll be the end of the world. And here we are, still here. I think it's one of the things activists need to do is to get over their hope that they're going to see some huge change overnight, or that some kind of permanent reform is around the corner, and then things are going to be fine. Or conversely, that things are going to be so bad that it'll be the end of the world. That's just not going to happen. I'm in my 50s, and I'm going to die before any of this is resolved. And that initially you don't want to believe that. You want to see your efforts bear some fruit. You want to see the energy and time that you've put into activism bear some fruit. But that again is a kind of an obsession for control. And if you read a little history, which we tend not to do, if you read your history, you'll realize that the fight that's going on against tyranny and destruction and war has been going on for thousands of years, and it'll continue to do so. And in the end, that actually, your motivation becomes a little more stable. Instead of operating in crisis mode, you begin to see that your efforts will make a difference, but you may not, you won't live long enough to see them. That you're not smart enough and long-lived enough to actually control the fruits of your labor. And that is actually very freeing.
Mm-hmm. I like what you said about that we are in the midst of the collapse, and that it's not something that's going to happen in the future, but it is happening around us all the time. It just happens so incrementally. We get used to it. And that is itself pretty freeing, I think, as well. Like Derek Jensen talks a lot about false hopes, and I think a lot of people do have a false hope that, you know, 2012 there'll be a massive consciousness shift or there'll be this industrial collapse. But
yeah, we're very fond of dismissing past cultures for being superstitious. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, that there's a lot of magical thinking going on now. We think the hydrogen engine is going to save us from fossil fuels, and we think some legislation to protect our privacy will protect us from the capabilities of computers to spy on people. And I think that's one of the problems with expecting an apocalyptic doom or a magical saving of the world, is that you begin to put your hopes in false options. The question of surveillance and control, the issues we were looking at in Welcome to the Machine, is one of the classic false hopes is privacy. I mean, if you think about it, in older cultures, there was no such thing as privacy. You lived in a village, you met maybe 100 or 200 people in your whole life. You knew everybody, and you lived in a village or in a hunting and gathering band of 50 to 75 people, and everything was face to face. Everybody had essentially the same level of power. Some people were more skilled at some things than others. Some people were natural leaders, but everybody had essentially the same power. And if a leader got out of control, they were no longer the leader, and they didn't wield a huge technological advantage or a huge advantage in information. Someone didn't know more about you than you knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
So power relations never got unbalanced.
Yeah.
To any great degree. And that's just not true anymore. There are people that have vast wealth and vast power over others, and it's not reciprocal. So, again, it gets back to those power relations. Rather than looking at the technology or at a particular crisis, I think it's more helpful in the long run to look at how society is arranged and how, even on the individual level, how am I living my life? How do I spend my time? Who do I give my money to? Whose rules do I follow? I mean, ultimately, those are more useful questions. And the reliance on legislation, on the reliance on someone else is going to pass a law that will help protect my civil rights. The whole idea of privacy never arose. Privacy was never necessary until power relations were unequal. And then suddenly I wanted certain areas of my life to be under my control. So I said, that's my private, that's my private privilege. But why is that even necessary unless I've already given up my own power to someone else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. I wanted to say one thing that I got from the book is that I found it interesting that a high-ranking security chief in South Africa's apartheid regime, his greatest fear was not economic or industrial sabotage, but that people would be convinced to disregard law and order. And that was actually his greatest fear, he confessed later on. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about, like, when people hear all kinds of stuff like this, the question that people end up on is, well, what do we do? And for those people out there who are thinking, what do we do? And most of us already know what to do. But I'm curious to hear perspective on that. Like, what ways are there out of this machine?
Yeah. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another political scientist and philosopher in the 1700s, wrote that man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. The brain may become paralyzed and the individual still live. A man may remain an imbecile and still live. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire of escaping them. If there are slaves, it is because they've enslaved themselves. Force made the first slaves, and cowardice perpetuates the situation. And there's another writer even earlier in the 1500s, La Boetie, and he wrote an essay that's just incredibly inspiring because he points out that that everywhere kings and generals, whoever's, you know, think of the most powerful people on earth, and how do they get their power? They're still people. I mean, in the end, we are still living with the same capabilities as those people in village life where everyone had equal power. I ultimately have as much power as Bill Gates or George Bush. It, the extent to which someone else has more power than I do is dependent on me granting them that power. Ultimately, you know, George Bush is a human with with one head and two arms and two legs. If he's going to send people to their death, it depends on soldiers obeying his commands. If the soldiers in, even the soldiers in Iraq, we've got, what, 150,000 troops? But how many millions, how many tens of millions of people are there in Iraq? So people are ruled by their own consent. And that's true whether it's, whether you're talking about the ballot box or you're talking about machine guns. Ultimately, you know, soldiers have to obey orders. The population has to obey soldiers. And I think that's so that, you know, on the political level, on a legal level, on the administrative levels, which is where our minds usually are, that's not a very satisfying answer. You say, well, that's preposterous. George Bush has, you know, led this country into war. He's you know, he's got power. Well, 2/3 of Americans were in favor of the invasion of Iraq. And those numbers have slipped as the casualties have gone up, as the costs have, you know, become clearer. Those numbers have slipped. But 2/3 of Americans were in favor of invading Iraq. So, you know, do we blame George Bush or do we take responsibility for ourselves? And I think that's really why telling people that they already have freedom, they already have power, is scary. It's not a satisfying answer. We want to hear that somebody else with power is going to pass a law that's going to protect me. I don't want to hear that I'm already free and that I bear, you know, responsibility for living that way. We don't want to hear it, and we've got a million, you know, political and economic and social reasons why we can't exercise freedom and responsibility. But that's basically what freedom is. Security is slavery. It's slavery to the rules. It's slavery to you know, the military. It's slavery to surveillance. It's counterintuitive, but secure, living with an obsession for security is to condemn yourself to being a slave to a machine and to the social relations that machine requires. And freedom is responsibility. It means I've got to take responsibility for what I do for a living, for what I consume, for how I treat my neighbors, for how I elect my leaders and what I allow them to do. And, you know, people shy away from that. That people really like leaders and project their power onto leaders, which, of course, is where that power comes from. Mm-hmm. The power that George Bush or Bill Gates or Saddam Hussein or, you know, that their power is everyone's power that's been projected. It's the public's power that the public has projected onto that leader. And leaders are not in power for a day longer than the public, you know, is submits to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A couple more questions for you. Derek Denson says that you're one of the most amazing thinkers and researchers around. And I'm curious to know how what it's like working with Derek Jensen. You've written a few books with him.
It's challenging. Derek calls me up with an idea like this thing about surveillance technologies, and I think we were, I can't remember what the first technologies, I think it was the radio frequency ID tags, mm-hmm. and also the little aerial drones, these little, they have remote-controlled robots, 6 inches long, they weigh an ounce or two. And they've got cameras that can beam images back to a satellite or to a computer. So you can send these things into buildings. You can send them to sit over cities. Those are the first things we looked at. And so we say, hey, let's write an essay, about these surveillance technologies and alert people to where their research and development tax dollars are going at the universities. Well. A couple of years later, and suddenly we were talking about bureaucracy and science and control, and Derek's a challenge to work with because he makes connections between these things. That's how he ends up with. I mean, when he writes a book on his own, it ends up being 800 pages long. I don't have quite the stamina he does, so we try to keep him under 300 pages, but. Kind of corralling the scope of it and making it understandable to people with a wide range of interests is always the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to talk about at this point? We've been talking for 45 minutes, and unless you have anything else you feel like adding in at the end, I think that it's a kind of a good note to wrap things up on what you've been talking about for the last few minutes. I really like what you said about. I feel particularly inspired right now, just thinking about how we do always have that freedom and power, but it is really easy when, especially being absorbed in recent news developments and reading about all kinds of stuff, it's really easy to think that, others have more power than us to such a degree that we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, well, they do have more power, and I mean, clearly power is unequal. wealth and power are at record, imbalance right now. And you look at what the wealthy and of the world, what is it, 300 billionaires, the 300 richest people in the world have more wealth than half of the world's population. And with wealth, comes political power and technological power and ability to make decisions. So. Power is clearly imbalanced, but what I find most useful and most inspiring in my own work is to realize that there's not a certain amount of power in the world, and some people have it and some people don't. The power that I can exercise is up to me, and I can have infinitely more freedom and power over my life than I can imagine right now. But I can only have it if I take responsibility and exercise it. Mm-hmm. Power is not granted by someone else. It comes from my own doing, and so how far I can go and what I can do and what I can imagine is up to me and not up to George Bush.
Maybe to close things off, do you want to tell people about your website? And what kind of service you're offering with that? Because it's pretty comprehensive and vast.
Yeah, people can take a look at my website. It's endgame.org, and it's not about apocalypse and conspiracy. It's about ending the game of believing the illusions that we're fed in school and that we're fed every day in the mass media. Ending the game of that power imbalance that we've come to believe is natural and inevitable. We can end believing that. So endgame.org is the name of the website. And I do research for citizens and for public interest groups, environmental groups, labor unions, folks that are fighting for freedom on economic and political issues. So I invite people to take a look at the website and also at Derek Jensen's website, derekjensen.org.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, thanks a lot for talking, George. I really enjoyed this talk.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, much appreciated. And I'm going to put this on the internet as well, and I can let you know about that if you want to have a link on your website to this interview if you're interested.
Great. Thank you.
Cool. I'll talk to you later.
All right.
Thanks a lot, George.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.